This is WHFR Dearborn. Radiothon 2013 here at WHFR. Just once a year, we are asking for your support for our station. And we need that. WHFR does receive some student activity money from Henry Ford Community College. Comes off of what you might say user fees from the students. We get the same amount that the newspaper gets at the campus. Also the theater department and the music department and the sports teams get about 6 to 7 times that amount in order to keep them going. Big operation there. So we don't take a penny from the general fund at Henry Ford Community College. Your support would be greatly appreciated at this time for alternative, independent, non-commercial radio, local radio in this area with over 60 volunteers that to help keep us going. And we want you to be part of our family, too. Our loyal listeners are really an important part of who and what we are. And by golly, that's what this is all about. And we're happy to be here to take that call. 313-845-9676 is the number. 313-845-9676. And my name is Jay Koronik, and I'm here this hour because it's normally the Monday forum, and that's a special hour every week in which I, all humility aside, try to find some very interesting podcasts, some interesting little, you might call them radio shows, that are available only on the internet. And there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of them out there, not all of them are broadcastable because of FCC censorship rules, but nonetheless, there's some great educational things, and so I do a lot of listening each week, and I try to find things that are important. And right now I'm having, I have control over the computer, so that's wonderful. And so this hour, we're going to ask for your pledge. And, of course, you can go to our website directly and do an online pledge. You can see our pledge incentives. They're all there for you to choose if you like to. If you don't want to, fine. But we take Visa and MasterCard and Discover Card. WHFR.fm is the website. Phone number here, 313, you writing this down? 845-9676, 313-845-9676. We're in the live studio, which is option one, just a small little menu. Either the live studio is option one or the office side is option two, but I don't think anyone's answering that one right now. So option one, 313-845-9676. Option one. Because it is tax day for your federal taxes, I thought I would play a podcast from the National Tax Foundation. How appropriate for the first segment here. This only goes about 8.5 minutes, and then we'll be back more to tell you more about our pledge drive and to encourage you to make your pledge now. And by the way, these pledges are on your federal income tax deductible, because we're part of Henry Ford Community College, and that's a nonprofit organization, but not on this year's taxes. So if you haven't quite finished your filing for this year, you know, your pledge can't go on this year's. But next year, when you're doing it this time, you'll be glad you did, because if you itemize your federal tax return, you can get some money off thanks to your generosity to WHFR this year. So, again, right before I play the podcast from the National Tax Foundation, I'm going to give you the phone number again, 313-845-9676, and the website is WHFR.fm. Please make a generous pledge for our Radiothon 2013.
Welcome to the Tax Policy Podcast, produced by the Tax Foundation in Washington. Visit us online at www.taxfoundation.org.
Hello, and welcome to the Tax Policy Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Morrison, Manager of Communications here at the Tax Foundation. Our guest this week is Tax Foundation Chief Economist William McBride. Thanks for being with us, Will.
Thanks for having me.
Today we'll be talking about Tax Freedom Day and the new Tax Freedom Day report for 2013. To start with, Will, what exactly is it that Tax Freedom Day measures?
So, Tax Freedom Day is a calendar-based measure of the cost of government. And to do that, we total up all taxes paid at the federal, state, and local level. and we divide it by a measure of national income. So all this, these numbers come from various government agencies, particularly the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Congressional Budget Office. So the taxes paid include all of the big taxes and the small taxes, so the personal income taxes, payroll taxes, corporate income taxes, property and sales, and other smaller taxes. So we have, in dollar figures, we have this year that Americans will pay $2.76 trillion in federal taxes and another $1.46 trillion in state and local taxes. So as a share of total income, that represents 29.4% of total income. So on the calendar, that's 108 days out of 365. So that translates to a date of April 18th. So you can say that here we are in the first week of April. We still have yet to finish paying our tax burden at all levels of government.
All right, so this year we're looking at a date of April 18th. How has that changed from last year or, you know, previous years in the historical trend line?
Well, it's generally gone up and up. It was 100 years ago, Tax Freedom Day was in the month of January. And, you know, there's been a lot of things that have happened since then. We've had a number of wars and a huge expansion of the welfare state. But by all accounts, the federal government and state and local governments were performing their vital functions back then and at a much lower price. So the big expansion since then has been in the federal government, particularly during the Depression and World War II, and it never turned back. There's been an increase slightly from there in the size of the federal government, particularly in the 50s and the 60s, but we've kind of been steady since the 80s in terms of the size of the federal government. And in recent years, there has been a lot of volatility, and Tax Freedom Day has bounced around quite a lot since the late 90s. So the latest date on record was at the end of the Clinton era. It was May 1st, 2000, and that was the result of an economic boom and particularly the dot-com stock market bubble. And then since then, with the Bush tax cuts and then the huge volatility, the stock market collapse and housing market boom and bust, there's been huge volatility in the economy and tax revenues. So we've seen Tax Freedom Day come down a couple weeks back and forth, and but generally we've been in mid-April since that peak date in the year 2000.
Great. Now, you've also calculated individual dates for tax freedom in each of the 50 states. How do those dates vary across the country?
Well, they vary mainly according to income, average income in the states. So the richest states in the Northeast, particularly Connecticut is the richest state, they have the latest Tax Freedom Day. And that's because we have an extremely progressive federal income tax, the most progressive in the developed world, actually. So that means not only rich people pay a higher tax rate, but rich states pay a higher tax rate. So we have Connecticut with a tax freedom, the latest Tax Freedom Day, May 13th, and that's preceded by New York and New Jersey, also rich states. These states, coincidentally or not, rich states tend to also have high state and local taxes. So routinely, these states are ranked by our own rankings and others, they have very high tax burdens. And so at the other end of the spectrum, you have a lot of poor states with below average income. States like Mississippi, Louisiana, and Tennessee, they have the earliest tax freedom days. Mississippi's is the earliest at March 29th, and followed by Louisiana later in the day on March 29th, and Tennessee on April 2nd. And so in addition to being below average income states, and thus paying a lower federal income tax rate, these states also, coincidentally or not, tend to have low state and local tax burdens. So, for instance, Tennessee has no personal income tax except on dividends.
Now, how do the various categories of taxes contribute to the overall burden the Tax Freedom Day measures? How much of the year goes by to pay income taxes as opposed to sales taxes, for example?
Sure. So, as I mentioned, the federal income tax is extremely progressive. It is also the biggest tax by far. It takes 32 days to pay that federal income tax. It takes another 8 days to pay the state and local income taxes. Yeah, so together that's 40 days. That's by far the biggest chunk of tax. And then the second biggest is the payroll tax, which is almost entirely a federal tax. That takes 24 days, another 24 days to pay that. Then you've got the major state and local taxes, sales and property. It takes 15 days total to pay all sales and excise taxes. 13 of those are at the state and local level. And then for property taxes, which is entirely a state and local tax, it takes another 12 days to pay that. So then you've got the corporate income tax, which is takes 9 days total to pay. 8 of those days are from the federal income tax. That's because we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, whereas many states have no corporate income tax or generally corporate tax rates in the single digits. And then there's another for other various taxes, smaller taxes like federal tariffs and state taxes, etc. It takes another 7 days to pay those.
All right. And how does the budget deficit relate to Tax Freedom Day, and how do we incorporate that into the report?
Right. So, especially in recent years, the deficit has been a huge part of federal spending. So there's tax finance spending, and then there's deficit finance spending. So what we've done in recent years is add to Tax Freedom Day the deficit inclusive Tax Freedom Day. So that means we're taking into account the federal budget deficit, the annual deficit. We're not looking at all the state deficits, which are much smaller, but many states have a balanced budget amendment of some sort. The federal government has a huge federal deficit, pretty clearly. This year, it is $833 billion. That's down from a trillion or more in all of the previous 4 years. But this $833 billion adds another 21 days to Tax Freedom Day this year, putting it at May 9th.
All right, excellent. And that brings us to the end of another episode of the Tax Policy Podcast. I want to again thank our distinguished guests, my colleague, Tax Foundation Chief Economist Will McBride. Thanks again for being with us.
All right, thanks.
Make sure to follow Will on Twitter at EconoWill and keep up with his work on our website at taxfoundation.org. You can read this year's Tax Freedom Day report by going to the front page of our website, taxfoundation.org, or you can also go directly there from taxfreedomday.org. Thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week.
The Tax Policy Podcast is produced by the Tax Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit tax research group that has monitored fiscal policy at the federal, state, and local levels since 1937. Please help support our programs by making a tax-deductible contribution at www.taxfoundation.org.
This is Radiothon 2013. Please make a tax-deductible contribution to WHFR, the station that's allowing you to hear that podcast, because we think that the National Tax Foundation podcast, which come every couple of weeks or so, it's on a regular basis, onto their website, nationaltaxfoundation.org, I think it is. We're the ones that make the decision to choose the ones that are more interesting and relevant. I mean, I actually do survey. My name is Jay Koronik. I'm station advisor here, but I program this hour weekly. In case you wonder, who picks these things on Mondays from 6 to 7? Well, I do, and I listen to about 30 to 50. I monitor different podcasts, and I try to find ones that have some especially interesting topics. Not every week is it, do I think it's quite as interesting or earth changing as perhaps another week. So I try to pick the best of the podcasts that I'm currently monitoring. If you like that idea and approach, of course, if you like the approach of WHFR, alternative programming that other stations are not doing, either in this area or sometimes not even anywhere else in the United States, then you want to support WHFR. A pledge of just $30 will get you one of our new special logo, embroidered logo baseball caps. And if it's a first-time pledge, you also get this, a stainless steel metallic blue drinking cup. That's right. And if you're really lucky, are you feeling lucky, huh? One of the people that pledged this week, $30 or more, will actually win a drawing for a weekend lease of a new Ford Focus Electric. That's right, the all-electric version of the Ford Focus. And go ahead, see how far you can drive it in 3 days. And how many times you need to charge it up. But really something to show your friends. Really special deal there. Well, we're going to go back to another podcast that we normally feature here. And take your pledge as soon as we start that back up. Going to hear a disclaimer first, because all the opinions expressed on this show, in these podcasts, are not necessarily those of the station here at WHFR. No, it's not necessarily us. And it's not necessarily anyone here at Henry Ford Community College. So who is it? Just the people who are speaking. And no one told us to play these, and the college doesn't necessarily endorse them. So take a look at this official disclaimer and dial the phone number right now. I'll take your pledge right now and explain your incentive options at different pledge levels you like. 313-845-9676. Option one is the choice after the phone number to get right through to our live WHFR studio. You can also go online, of course, WHFR.fm, and with your MasterCard, Visa, or Discover card, handle the pledge right there. Yeah, but the phone number is studio, 313-845-9676. Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. Social entrepreneur Billy Parrish joins us today to talk about his company Mosaic, which connects people with high-quality solar projects to invest in. We'll also hear from Josh Buswell-Charco, the executive director of GreenCore, the field school for environmental organizing. And hear from Avital Andrews, the green living editor at Sierra Magazine, about eco-friendly fonts. Billy Parrish is the co-author of Making Good, Finding Meaning, Money, and Community in a Changing World. He's also the founder of the Energy Action Coalition, one of the largest youth advocacy groups working on the climate crisis. He's now a social entrepreneur and has been honored by Rolling Stone as a climate hero. He joins us today to talk about his new project, a company called Mosaic that helps connect people with high-quality solar projects to invest in. Welcome.
Hi.
It's great to have you here. I know we had you on the show a while back when your book came out, and it's good to have you in our studio.
Likewise. Thanks.
So we're really excited about Mosaic, this new project, and I'm wondering if you can start by telling us a little bit about how you got the idea to start Mosaic.
So Dan Rosen, one of my co-founders, and I have both done a lot of work in Native American communities trying to figure out how to support them to develop and own their own renewable energy resources. As we started doing that work, we applied to a business incubator called the Unreasonable Institute in Colorado.
Great name.
Yeah. And while we were there, we actually realized that at the core of that idea was an even simpler idea, that all of us should be able to own and develop our own renewable energy resources. All of us should be able to be part of the transition to clean energy. So we built Mosaic as a platform to enable people to invest in financing the clean energy infrastructure we need to get to 100% clean power.
Now, how does Mosaic work? What does that mean that people can invest in these projects?
So we go out and we find the best projects that need financing.
And in many cases, my understanding is these are not the big, huge kind of solar factories, right? These are small local projects that communities wish they could fund but don't have the money to fund.
Yeah. So we're right now focused on community scale solar projects. And there's just not enough financing out there from the banks to do those projects. So a lot of those projects are languishing. You know, these are great investment grade projects that we're enabling people to collectively invest in.
So in other words, if a school wants to put solar panels on the roof, or if a low-income housing project wants to put solar panels on their roof, right now, without Mosaic, how would they do that? They would try to go to the bank and get a loan, and they might be approved or not. I mean, how does that work, and what problem is Mosaic solving?
So we are substituting people for the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Up until this point, energy investing has been a bank-only thing, and there are only a few players in the space. So the cost of the financing that they provide is too high, and there's just not enough of it. The banks are interested in doing utility-scale projects and big tranches of cookie cutter residential projects. But that sort of commercial segment of the market is not being filled by the banks right now. So Mosaic's really filling that need while providing an amazing investment product for the general public.
Well, let's talk about that investment side of things, because it's clear how it benefits the community that wants to put solar panels on their community center. They get a loan with, I'm assuming, lower interest rates than what a bank might provide. But how do the folks who are investing actually benefit?
Our first projects have ranged between 4.5% annual rate of return and 6.38% annual rate of return. So Mosaic passes on most of the interest that we collect for financing these projects to our investors. So we just take 1% of off the top, and the rest goes towards paying back the investors.
So the investors are making a profit by helping to create the green energy revolution.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that you're a little different from other companies in the sense that almost anyone can be an investor, at least in certain states. You don't have to be rich to qualify to invest in these projects.
Yeah, so that's been our mission since the beginning, is to open up this asset class to everyone. Right now, residents of California and New York can invest for as little as $25 in a solar project. We also have investments still available for accredited investors in all 50 states, people who have over $1 million of net worth or make over $200,000 a year in income. So, you know, that's a lot of people across the country. And really, for the first time, we're making it very, very easy for people to invest in clean energy.
So do you have middle-class families, I mean, not accredited investors, people like a, you know, school teacher in LA or a grandma in Fresno who are actually putting money down into these projects?
Yeah, so we just launched on January 7th for these first return on investment projects. And in that one day, over 400 people became clean energy investors, people from all walks of life. We sold out all of the publicly available projects we had in less than 24 hours. So, you know, it's just amazing to see how the public reacted. For the first time they could invest, there was all this pent-up demand, and they fully funded all those projects. So we have one project still available to accredited investors, but the ones that are open to everyone in California and New York are all sold out. So we're working to get more up on the platform now, but it was just amazing to see that demand is there, that people want to invest in tangible assets that they can understand instead of, you know, Wall Street or putting their money in a bank and who knows what it's doing.
Well, also, it's just such a feel-good thing to think that even if you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of savings, you can still chip in $50 and, you know, be an investor in a really great solar project at a maybe even a local community center that you know.
Yeah. The green space has had this baggage around, you know, you need to take lower returns or, you know, you need to do less of things. And for us, it's exciting to kind of reposition green as it can be good for your wallet, good for your community, good for climate. We actually can have all of those things, and that's what we're trying to do with Mosaic.
What I think is really interesting is that a lot of people think of this space or have traditionally thought of this space more as charity, something they have to make a donation to do. If they want, you know, if they want to create the solar revolution, they should write a check to a small nonprofit that's working to do this locally. What's cool about this is that it's not actually a donation. You get your money back. You put the money in, you help with the solar revolution, and you actually make a return on it, right?
Yeah. And right now, we just have these debt investments that people can participate in, but we're developing IRA products so people can retire on the sun. People can really grow their money. And, you know, I have two little kids and I want to create an educational savings account for them. And I don't want to put that into investments that are going to kill their future. I want to put the money that I need to save for them for college into something that's going to be good for their future. And so we're creating other kinds of investment products that allow people to grow their money with the sun.
And is it the same idea that all these investment products would be available to people who are just middle-class families?
Absolutely. We're democratizing energy and finance, which are the two biggest industries in the world and two of the most broken industries in the world. And we think people participating in them is going to be really important to solving and fixing those industries.
Now, I noticed back in the day when I first heard about your company, you were Solar Mosaic, and now you're just Mosaic. Is that because you're thinking of expanding to other things beyond solar?
Yes. Our vision is abundant clean energy for and by the people. And that involves electric vehicle infrastructure, battery storage, energy efficiency, wind. You know, it's going to take a lot of different things to get us to 100% clean energy. we're very excited about solar. That's where we're starting. But, you know, we want to finance all kinds of things and allow people to participate.
Tell us a little bit more about your personal journey. You know, you started as an activist. I know there's this legendary story about how you dropped out of Yale on a dream to pursue founding a climate movement for youth, and you ended up indeed doing that and starting the Energy Action Coalition, which has been hugely successful. What is your personal transition like to go from that sort of more confrontational activism to this different way of providing people tools, let's say, in the financial realm?
So, you know, there was a moment for me after we lost the battle in Copenhagen, after we failed to pass federal climate legislation in the U.S., that I just felt that we needed to try something new. We needed to deepen and broaden our constituency. We needed to accelerate the solution side of the equation. And I kind of fell in love with solar and clean technologies. And as I looked at the math on climate, that was the X factor that felt to me like it could really avoid the worst consequences of climate change. If we can rapidly accelerate the transition to clean energy, I think that's our best hope for avoiding, you know, the terrible things that I've been worrying about for my whole career. And to have a value proposition where people can make money solving the climate, leveraraging the capital markets, leveraging the incredible power of capitalism, it just feels amazing. I'm so happy to be on the business side. And, you know, I'm going to be in D.C. for the Keystone XL protests. But I'm excited to be building on the solution side and working with all my friends, you know, at the Sierra Club and in other movement organizations that are, you know, on the nonprofit side as well.
Now, what do you say when people tell you that sort of right-wing talking point about how solar can never get to scale? Solar can never replace dirty energy because we only get a small percentage of our power from solar, and even if we doubled it, it would still be small. How do you respond to that?
Happily, there is now an existence proof that that's false. You look at Germany, you know, last summer they got over half of their power from the sun, you know, throughout parts of the year, and 17 times more solar was installed in the last decade than the analysts projected. Mm-hmm. The International Energy Agency is now ramping up their predictions of how much solar there will be in our electricity mix by 2050. We will be mainly a solar-powered world. You know, it really is only a small set of folks, many of whom are funded by the fossil fuel industry, who are denying that clean energy can meet most, if not all, of our energy needs in the long term.
Okay, so for our listeners who are interested now and want to find out more about Mosaic or possibly even invest, what do you recommend? What are the next steps?
Joinmosaic.com is our website. It's very simple. It takes a couple minutes to set up an account. We will have our next round of investments for everyone in California and New York in a couple weeks. And we already have investments for accredited investors in all 50 states.
Now, just tell us really quickly, why is it for non-accredited investors, average folks in California and New York, but then in the other states that's not available yet? Do you hope to bring it there soon?
One of the hardest nuts we had to crack in building this business was getting approval from state security regulators to offer our investments to the public. We've now done that in California and New York and are working to expand into other states.
And that's because they usually try to protect you know, middle-class families who might be hit too hard by a loss in the investment. Is that right? So they only let people invest who have enough net worth that it wouldn't devastate their finances?
Right.
So it must be a sign of confidence that in California and New York, they're saying that solar, this is a good enough investment that they're willing to let middle-class families actually go into it because they don't perceive it as being that risky.
Yeah. And, you know, it is an investment. There are risks involved. We are very transparent about those risks. Mm-hmm. People can download the prospectus for each of our projects on the platform. They're all there.
To wrap up here, I'm curious to hear from you. What are you most optimistic about when it comes to the clean energy future?
We actually built Mosaic for the next generation of clean energy technologies. I'm seeing solar and wind and battery and motor technologies on the horizon that will be an order of magnitude better than what is currently on the market. And when we get to that point where the new clean energy technologies will be so much more cost effective than the fossil fuel technologies that dominate our energy mix now, that they will replace them faster than we ever thought was possible.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Billy Parrish. He's the founder of a company called Mosaic that helps connect people with high-quality solar projects to invest in. For more information, you can visit them at joinmosaic.com. Joining us now in our studio is Josh Buswell Charco. He's the executive director for Green Corps, the Field School for Environmental Organizing. Welcome.
Thanks, Aurelie.
So Green Corps recently had its 20th anniversary. I'm curious if you can tell our listeners a little bit more about what that means, the founding of Green Corps and the organization's mission. What do you guys do?
Absolutely. So the mission of Green Corps is to train organizers, provide field support for today's critical environmental campaigns, and graduate activists with the skills, temperament, and commitment to fight and win tomorrow's environmental battles. And we got our start out of Earth Day 1990. So this was the largest Earth Day in history. Over 200 million people took part. And there was just a surge of interest in the environment coming out of that. So you might remember there was this book that came out, 50 Easy Things You Can Do to Save the Planet.
I think I owned that book.
And, recycling became really popular, so curbside recycling. And academia followed suit. So we saw a surge in the creation of environmental studies departments. And so as kind of a consequence of that, there were all of these students that were graduating from college. They had majored in environmental studies. They were really interested in environmental issues. And they wanted to put their values to work when they graduated. But there weren't many places for them to go, right? So most of the environmental organizations out there were looking for people who had experience. And so the options for them were either to go and intern or to go to law school. Simultaneously, while that's going on, a lot of groups in the environmental movement were more focused on kind of inside the beltway activities, right? So more kind of lobbying in D.C. And they weren't really capitalizing on this interest in communities all across the country in the environment. So USPIRG in 1992 started Green Corps. USPIRG had been training people in the skills of organizing, but they weren't focused specifically on the environment. So they created Green Corps to be a field school, almost like a graduate school, to teach people how to do environmental organizing through a combination of learning in a classroom type setting, bringing in issue experts, and then actually deploying these people to go and work on urgent environmental campaigns in communities across the country.
I think for our listeners, sometimes people aren't really clear on what is meant by organizing. So when you talk about environmental organizing, what do you really mean?
Absolutely. Organizing is the process of activating and engaging citizens to wield their collective power to enact change.
So kind of what people think about when they think about campaigning, but on the local level.
I think it kind of flows from the premise of we're stronger united than we are divided. And so we choose environmental organizing for a couple of reasons. One, we think that the big environmental problems that we face are political problems at their core. Basically, our decision makers lack the political will to do the right thing for our environment. So if you believe that, then the second thing is that while we certainly need more environmental lawyers and we need more environmental educators, we need a lot more environmental organizers to go out there and mobilize the people power to hold our decision makers accountable for their decisions on the environment. Mm-hmm. So, when you look at the myriad of environmental issues that are out there, right, global warming, chemicals in our food, mountaintop removal. There are solutions out there to these problems, right? Ralph Nader has this terrific quote where he says, America has more problems than it deserves and more solutions than it applies. These solutions, they're right there. They're at our fingertips. And a lot of times they're just not being implemented because our decision makers are being unduly influenced, frankly, by, big corporations and polluting industries. So while we certainly think that we need to get out there and educate people about, environmental problems, and we certainly need to be, suing these companies when they're breaking the law, we also think that our greatest strength is people. So we need to be going out there and organizing people to hold our decision makers accountable if we're going to see the kinds of changes that we need for a better planet.
Right. I mean, I think that it's just clear that even though litigation plays an important role, we're not going to be able to sue our way out of this problem.
Right. And we also kind of think that, the law is certainly important, but it doesn't capitalize on our biggest asset, which is people. Right? People want a clean environment. They want healthy air. They want clean water to drink. And so organizing allows us to take advantage of that asset.
So Green Corps was founded to give these young, passionate college students a way to enter that career and also to become organizers. What has that meant over the past 20 years? What kinds of people have you trained? I mean, who's come out of the program? What kind of an impact is it making?
Yeah.
Because I know, I mean, one of the interesting things about Green Corps is that it's a pretty small organization. I mean, you're only training, I think, anywhere between 15 and 35 people a year, but those people have gone on to have a really surprising amount of influence in the environmental world.
We're, you know, tremendously proud of all of our alumni. So we've graduated over 300 people now in the past 20 years, and we're pleased to say that, you know, 80% of them are staying engaged in kind of the broader social change movement. So, you know, we've got graduates, folks like Sarah Hodgson, who works here at the Sierra Club as the conservation director, is a Green Corps alum. Phil Radford, who's the executive director of Greenpeace USA, was in the Green Corps class of 1999. Justin Rubin, who was the former executive director of MoveOn.org, is a Green Corps alum. Heather Smith, who's the president of Rock the Vote, is a Green Corps alum. So national organizations, but then also a lot of regional organizations. So Aaron Viles, who's the deputy director for the Gulf Restoration Network, a group that's doing terrific work on the BP oil disaster, is a Green Corps alum. Greg Small, who runs Climate Solutions, which is doing a lot of work around promoting clean energy and clean energy jobs in the Pacific Northwest, is a Green Corps alum. So it's really neat to look across the broader environmental and social change movement and see all of these people who learn these valuable skills during their Green Corps year and are now putting them to good use for a better planet.
What does the training look like? How do you give people skills to be able to run campaigns against huge, massive, wealthy corporations? Is that something you can teach? Is it just about tenacity and ingenuity? Mm-hmm. You know, how much of it is instinct and how much of it is skill?
Yeah. I mean, there are a whole set of skills that you can teach people. You know, when I was in college and I was involved in activism, I always wished that I'd actually learned some of these skills and I was working on campaigns. But the way that the program works is it's divided into three components. So the first part is the classroom training component. So all of our organizers receive about 7 weeks of training in a classroom type setting spread out over the course of the year. And they're learning everything from, you know, basic recruitment 101, how you actually go out and find someone and recruit them to get involved in your campaign, and then how you develop them as leaders, how to build a coalition, how to talk to the media, how to develop a campaign plan. So really the nuts and bolts not only of running a campaign, but I think the foundation for running an organization in a lot of ways. And one thing that I think is particularly neat about our classroom training component is we bring in lots of issue experts and people that have been in the field for a really long time. So, you know, you might get a lecture from Bill McKibben, who's, you know, a noted author and environmental activist, or, you know, Margie Ault, who's the executive director of Environment America, might come in and do a training for you. But we definitely believe in learning by doing. So the bulk of the year is actually spent in the field running urgent environmental campaigns. And so, you know, in the past couple of years, we've actually done a lot of work with the Sierra Club working on the Beyond Coal campaign. So embedding organizers in communities across the country to retire some of the nation's oldest and dirtiest coal-fired power plants. We've done a lot of work with an organization called Food and Water Watch, working to promote more environmentally friendly farm practices in the next farm bill. So it's neat because, you know, you might be fresh out of college, but you're working on these really important, very profound issues at a really young age. The final part of the year is job placement. So when the year comes to a conclusion, we work with all of our organizers to help them to find a career in the broader social change movement. So we have more than 300 alumni that have gone through our program. We've partnered with dozens of organizations over the year. And our organizers have a reputation for being, you know, hardworking, goal-oriented, very strategic thinkers. And so as the year comes to a conclusion, we help all of our organizers to kind of launch their career in the broader social change movement.
And how do you recruit people? How can interested candidates apply for the program?
The process is pretty easy. So basically, so long as you've got a college diploma and you care about the environment, you can apply to Green Corps. And
can you apply before you get the diploma, like if you're still in your senior year?
Yes, you can certainly apply. And in fact, you should apply if you're a senior, but you could certainly apply after you've graduated too. And the easiest way to do that is actually just to go to greencorps.org, and all of the directions are right there.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Josh Buswell Charco. He's the executive director of Green Corps, the Field School for Environmental Organizing. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor at Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Orly.
So today we're going to talk about something a little more unusual. I know we usually talk with you about things like eco-friendly tips for certain holidays or which kind of ice cream is the greenest and that type of thing. But we're going to talk about something you did recently for Sierra Magazine that's actually about fonts.
Right, right.
What does that mean to be a green font, like a computer font? I mean, how did you even come to that topic?
Yeah, well, I came to that topic because I found out about a typeface that a man named Steve Madison had designed, and it was inspired by Half Dome in Yosemite. So I just got really intrigued, and I wanted to interview him about this process of designing a font based on something in Yosemite. So I called him up and just had a conversation and sort of wrote my piece about the process of him designing this font. So this particular font isn't necessarily eco-friendly, although there are others. We can get that to that in a second, but it's basically a tribute to Yosemite. He's a really big typeface designer. He created the default fonts on the Android and Windows smartphones. And if you play Xbox, which I don't, but I know a lot of people do, he created all the letters that you see when you play video games on the Xbox. He's both an artist and a technician, and he's never really designed a font just for making himself happy. And so he just went out into Yosemite and looked to the mountains for inspiration and just did a bunch of pencil sketches. And in the magazine, you can see the sketches that he actually did and how the letters look. But the letters themselves are hollowed out, like the O, the hollow out in the O is actually the exact contour of Half Dome.
Hmm.
It's a little hard to explain without having the visual, so you really need to go to sierramagazine.com to read the piece. But it's great. And he envisions these letters being used for anything kind of eco-friendly or organic. He pictures them on, say, like an organic, eco-friendly coffee brand or something that really just needs to convey a sense of earthiness.
Well, I mean, when you do look at the letters, I mean, they look earthy. It's interesting how different fonts can evoke different emotions. But,
you know,
I wouldn't have guessed Yosemite instantly, but when I know the backstory, when you see the font, it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, exactly. He had a great quote. He says it's a hidden homage to Half Dome, and he says that computers are really good at making straight lines and perfect circles, but to give the letters a more natural look, he drew them freehand with a pencil and just it made sure to include the unique contrast, which he describes as the glacial polishing with jaggedness and gradual smooth curves that all of a sudden sharpen off into an abrupt straight line. And those are the elements that he put into it. It's kind of, like I said, it's an art and a craft at the same time. And it's something that you can actually get on your computer. It's at fonts.com, and you can get it for starting at $54 and then going way up for a lot of more professional uses. But
and what is the font called?
It's called Massif Pro.
Massif Pro. Interesting.
Yes, yes.
Now, I was curious about something else that you said. You said there's also such a thing as eco-friendly fonts. How is that possible? What does that even mean?
Yeah, there's one in particular that's just called EcoFont, and it purports to save ink. And if you can imagine it, it has a bunch of little holes in the letters, kind of like Swiss cheese, but the holes are so small that you can't even see them when you print them out. So basically, you're printing out a document. It looks the same. You know, it looks like maybe Arial or something, but it's a lot less ink that's being used to
And so fewer ink cartridges to throw away.
Exactly. Exactly.
And
less resources needed to produce the ink itself. But, you know, that's all with a caveat is that it's better not to print at all. If you're going to print, it's better to use an eco font that saves ink.
You just get it at...
You can get it at a website called Dutch. It's DUTCH.CO, not com.
.co. Have to look into that. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Avital Andrews. She's the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
And this is Jay Koronek at WHFR.FM, the station making waves, doing things a little differently than any other station in Detroit. And that's only possible because of your pledges of support this 1 week every year. That's right, just for 1 week, only one time each show. That is every hour, just that's it, one show per week, and that's it. And we won't take up your time the rest of the year. We have no commercials. We have no funding directly from Henry Ford Community College, although student fees pay 40% of our annual budget. But we can't exist without outside pledges of support. And so all this week, it's your chance to be a loyal listener and part of our family by giving us a pledge of, we hope, $30 or more. And we do have pledge incentives, but I won't go into those now. The phone number is 313-845-9676. But while I'm talking, I can't answer the phone. Let me just explain that this hour is the Monday Forum. And you know, every Monday I try to choose the most interesting podcast of about 40 or 50 that I monitor that are available on the internet. And so I put a lot of time into that so that you don't have to. And so you never can get enough science. And so sometimes we do science things such as the Sierra Club radio show, which is actually on a station in San Francisco, but they put it on their website, and it's available through the iTunes store and elsewhere. But it's really good environmental news and ecology information once a week, very professionally done by another nonprofit, the Sierra Club. If you're listening to this show as one of our podcasts, because we archive all of our talk shows, the Monday Forum, the Tuesday Forum, and that's from 1 to 2 o'clock on Tuesday, and also our WHFR Journal, which is our local Dearborn and surrounding area news program. This Friday, we're going to have a all-hour, going to have a special interview with Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. And but all of these are available on our website immediately after broadcast. You can just go to WHFR.fm and listen to them there. And if you're listening to this hour as a podcast right now from WHFR.fm, you can still make that pledge. No, we don't call it Radiothon 2013 for nothing, even though we're only going to talk about it on air for 1 week. You can pledge anytime you want to. So middle of the night, whatever, go to WHFR.fm. It's the middle of the night 3 months from now, which is April the 15th. Go ahead. Let that generous impulse flow. And just go to WHFR.fm. The pledge incentives are all pictured there. And in addition, well, I'm here, and I'll take your phone call. Last in the hour is a presentation from TED. Laura Snyder, who really knows her philosophy and her history of philosophy, is going to be talking about the Philosophical Breakfast Club, which is a group of philosophers and early scientists that had some really amazing ideas that they share. In fact, even in this 12-minute presentation, it's going to let you know how did the term scientist happen? How did it first come up? It wasn't in existence before 1833, in fact. So very helpful. Often I do try to find Philosophy Talk or Philosophy Bites. These are two different shows. And then TED, which is not referring to the movie about the bear, but it's Technology, Entertainment, and Design. It was a one-time conference in 1984 to get some big ideas out there from people in all the smartest people in the world. And it's now been an annual conference since 1990 and has spread to all kinds of mini TED conferences all over the world. And from their website, TED.com, you can actually watch these people do these presentations. No presentation can be more than 18 minutes. And as I said, Laura Snyder, Philosophical Breakfast Club here, it's 12 minutes. While you're listening to this, great time to call us at WHFR and make that pledge, either online, WHFR.fm is the website, or call me right now, 313-845-9676, option one for the live studio, 313-845-9676, option one. We really need your support for Radiothon 2013 here at the station, making waves.
I'd like you to come back with me for a moment to the 19th century, specifically to June 24th, 1833. The British Association for the Advancement of Science is holding its third meeting at the University of Cambridge. It's the first night of the meeting, and a confrontation is about to take place that will change science forever. An elderly white-haired man stands up. The members of the association are shocked to realize that it's the poet, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who hadn't even left his house in years until that day. They're even more shocked by what he says. "You must stop calling yourselves natural philosophers." Coleridge felt that true philosophers like himself pondered the cosmos from their armchairs. They were not mucking around in the fossil pits or conducting messy experiments with electrical piles like the members of the British Association. The crowd grew angry and began to complain loudly. A young Cambridge scholar named William Whewell stood up and quieted the audience. He politely agreed that an appropriate name for the members of the association did not exist. "If philosophers is taken to be too wide and lofty a term," he said, "then, by analogy with artist, we may form scientist." This was the first time the word scientist was uttered in public, only 179 years ago. I first found out about this confrontation when I was in graduate school, and it kind of blew me away. I mean, how could the word scientist not have existed until 1833? What were scientists called before? What had changed to make a new name necessary precisely at that moment? Prior to this meeting, those who studied the natural world were talented amateurs. Think of the country clergyman or squire collecting his beetles or fossils, like Charles Darwin, for example. Or the hired help of a nobleman, like Joseph Priestley, who was the literary companion to the Marquis of Lansdowne when he discovered oxygen. After this, they were scientists, professionals, with a particular scientific method, goals, societies, and funding. Much of this revolution can be traced to four men who met at Cambridge University in 1812. Charles Babbage, John Herschel, Richard Jones, and William Whewell. These were brilliant, driven men who accomplished amazing things. Charles Babbage, I think known to most Tedsters, invented the first mechanical calculator and the first prototype of a modern computer. John Herschel mapped the stars of the southern hemisphere and, in his spare time, co-invented photography. I'm sure we could all be that productive without Facebook or Twitter to take up our time. Richard Jones became an important economist who later influenced Karl Marx. And Whewell not only coined the term scientist, as well as the words anode, cathode, and ion, but spearheaded international big science with his global research on the tides. In the Cambridge winter of 1812 and 1813, the four met for what they called philosophical breakfasts. They talked about science and the need for a new scientific revolution. They felt science had stagnated since the days of the scientific revolution that had happened in the 17th century. It was time for a new revolution, which they pledged to bring about. And what's so amazing about these guys is not only did they have these grandiose undergraduate dreams, but they actually carried them out, even beyond their wildest dreams. And I'm going to tell you today about four major changes to science these men made. About 200 years before, Francis Bacon, and then later Isaac Newton, had proposed an inductive scientific method. Now, that's a method that starts from observations and experiments and moves to generalizations about nature called natural laws, which are always subject to revision or rejection should new evidence arise. However, in 1809, David Ricardo muddied the waters by arguing that the science of economics should use a different deductive method. The problem was that an influential group at Oxford began arguing that because it worked so well in economics, this deductive method ought to be applied to the natural sciences too. The members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club disagreed. They wrote books and articles promoting inductive method in all the sciences that were widely read by natural philosophers, university students, and members of the public. Reading one of Herschel's books was such a watershed moment for Charles Darwin that he would later say, "Scarcely anything in my life made so deep an impression on me. It made me wish to add my mite to the accumulated store of natural knowledge." It also shaped Darwin's scientific method, as well as that used by his peers. Previously, it was believed that scientific knowledge ought to be used for the good of the king or queen, or for one's own personal gain. For example, ship captains needed to know information about the tides in order to safely dock at ports. Harbor masters would gather this knowledge and sell it to the ship captains. The Philosophical Breakfast Club changed that, working together. Whewell's worldwide study of the tides resulted in public tide tables and tidal maps that freely provided the harbor master's knowledge to all ship captains. Herschel helped by making tidal observations off the coast of South Africa, and as he complained to Whewell, he was knocked off the docks during a violent high tide for his trouble. The four men really helped each other in every way. They also relentlessly lobbied the British government for the money to build Babbage's engines because they believed these engines would have a huge practical impact on society. In the days before pocket calculators, the numbers that most professionals needed, bankers, insurance agents, ship captains, engineers, were to be found in lookup books like this, filled with tables of figures. These tables were calculated using a fixed procedure over and over by part-time workers known as, and this is amazing, computers. But these calculations were really difficult. I mean, this nautical almanac published the lunar differences for every month of the year. Each month required 1,365 calculations, so these tables were filled with mistakes. Babbage's difference engine was the first mechanical calculator devised to accurately compute any of these tables. Two models of his engine were built in the last 20 years by a team from the Science Museum of London using his own plans. This is the one now at the Computer History Museum in California. And it calculates accurately. It actually works. Later, Babbage's analytical engine was the first mechanical computer in the modern sense. It had a separate memory and central processor. It was capable of iteration, conditional branching, and parallel processing, and it was programmable using punched cards, an idea Babbage took from Jacquard's loom. Tragically, Babbage's engines never were built in his day because most people thought that non-human computers would have no usefulness for the public. Founded in Bacon's time, the Royal Society of London was the foremost scientific society in England, and even in the rest of the world. By the 19th century, it had become a kind of gentleman's club, populated mainly by antiquarians, literary men, and the nobility. The members of the Philosophical Breakfast Club helped form a number of new scientific societies, including the British Association. These new societies required that members be active researchers publishing their results. They reinstated the tradition of the Q&A after scientific papers were read, which had been discontinued by the Royal Society as being ungentlemanly. And for the first time, they gave women a foot in the door of science. Members were encouraged to bring their wives, daughters, and sisters to the meetings of the British Association. And while the women were expected to attend only the public lectures and the social events, like this one, they began to infiltrate the scientific sessions as well. The British Association would later be the first of the major national science organizations in the world to admit women as full members. Up to the 19th century, natural philosophers were expected to pay for their own equipment and supplies. Occasionally, there were prizes, such as that given to John Harrison in the 18th century for solving the so-called longitude problem. But prizes were only given after the fact, when they were given at all. On the advice of the Philosophical Breakfast Club, the British Association began to use the extra money generated by its meetings to give grants for research in astronomy, the tides, fossil fish, shipbuilding, and many other areas. These grants not only allowed less wealthy men to conduct research, but they also encouraged thinking outside the box, rather than just trying to solve one preset question. Eventually, the Royal Society and the scientific societies of other countries followed suit, and this has become, fortunately, it's become a major part of the scientific landscape today. So, the Philosophical Breakfast Club helped invent the modern scientist. That's the heroic part of their story. There's a flip side as well. They did not foresee at least one consequence of their revolution. They would have been deeply dismayed by today's disjunction between science and the rest of culture. It's shocking to realize that only 28% of American adults have even a very basic level of science literacy. And this was tested by asking simple questions like, did humans and dinosaurs inhabit the Earth at the same time? And what proportion of the Earth is covered in water? Once scientists became members of a professional group, they were slowly walled off from the rest of us. This is the unintended consequence of the revolution that started with our four friends. Charles Darwin said, I sometimes think that general and popular treatises
WHFR,
are almost as important to the progress of science as original work. In fact, Origin of